Welcome everyone to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thank you for joining Productivity Book Group. This is our first discussion of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Powerful Lessons in Personal Change by the late Dr. Stephen R. Covey. We'll be discussing the parts 1 and 2 of the best-selling book, covering an introduction of Dr. Covey's The 7 Habits Paradigm, along with Habits 1, 2, and 3. Let's start off the discussion with a warm welcome back to our discussion group. It's September and all, and not yet autumn, but like feeling like it at least today. What did you know about the 7 Habits Paradigm before reading this book? Is this your first time reading it? And what is your initial reaction to the book so far before we get into the specifics? Did you have an initial sort of, you know, emotional response to the material that we read? I just want to open that up to everybody.
Well, Ray, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Ray. I'd say this is definitely not the first time I've read the book. I've probably read it a dozen times over the many, many years and taught a lot of people in my business life some of the things found within the book. But the very first time I read it, it really excited me. It motivated me a tremendous amount because I didn't think there had ever been a book like it before. It was not just a self-help book like you read so often in the 70s and 80s. It seemed to be more practical, yet it also made you think a lot deeper. And I would say that book, it changed my life to some extent when I was a lot younger. It's been a long time.
Absolutely. That's great. And it's good to have you on the phone since you have, you know, read the book several times and have a lot of experience with it. I come from that same experience as you, I believe. I read the book several times, and it definitely was a life-changing experience for me, along with reading First Things First and The Eighth Habit eventually. And I really wish that I had actually read The Eighth Habit so many years earlier. But it was really one of those cases where I just didn't, you know, you think that a book that it just says The Eighth Habit, you're like, well, there's 7 other habits. I've got to really work on these. And so I put it off because I thought I was still working on the 7, and I really appreciated The Eighth Habit, and I'm looking forward to reading that with the book as well very soon. But thanks, Tom.
Sure.
Others?
Hey, it's Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hey. So reading it now, I realize that I read this back in the early 90s. And reading it again, I have a really clear understanding of what a difference 20 years makes in understanding. But it's really interesting. Like this read, it seems that the information is a little less about being effective in a workplace and more about base level spiritualness and being a good person and that sort of thing. At least that's what I'm getting from it, this read. I'm finding it very interesting and like very, very affirming and very, an interesting way of looking at, it's a different paradigm, I guess, you know?
Yeah, that's great. And so it's interesting to see how people focus on different pieces of themselves as they do a reread through a book that is as transformational as this one is. That's really great. That's a great perspective. Thank you.
Sure.
How about you, Denise?
I'm kind of like Michelle. I read it in, must have been the early 90s, and I haven't read it again since this. So it's I'm having to take a lot. It's taking me longer to get through it this time because I think I'm pausing more. And it is probably my 20 years of maturity on it that is making me stop and think just a little more than I did when I read it at, 20. So I'm enjoying it, but it's probably forcing me into comfort areas where I don't need to or don't want to go yet right now.
I totally understand that. I remember the first 2 times I read it, I refused to do any of the activities. And actually, the version of the book I read back then didn't have as much of the materials, I don't believe. I don't have that original book. But for some reason, I didn't believe it had all the exercises that he added in the revised version. And I'm not sure about that, but I remember not doing them. And then eventually, I was like, okay, I'm going to do these activities. I'm going to do the proactivity 30-day test and, you know, all of those things, and started to see the changes with the habit changes. So I completely understand that. I'd like to talk about Dr. Covey's sort of contrasting of the personality and character ethics. I'm wondering if people sort of have that distinction in their own lives as they read materials. I think Dr. Covey clearly states that there's a disadvantage to being sort of personality ethic driven, and that's what we've been taught for these last, you know, X number of years. And I think he's sort of like taking a side jab at Dale Carnegie specifically right there in the first chapter of the book. But even though I happen to be a huge fan of Dale Carnegie's work, Dr. Covey's work, I found it to be sort of funny that he makes it that jab. And I was curious about other people sort of, do you see a distinction between the two of them, and what's sort of your relationship there with it?
So I actually, when I was reading about the difference between the character and the personality, I could really see, the difference between the two. I really do recognize that. I don't think I did when I was 20. I don't think I had the experience behind me to understand that difference. I definitely do now, and I can look at, and I'm having the same thing as Denise, where I'm reading really slowly. I'm really soaking it all in. I'm really like thinking about it a lot, you know. So I'm sort of looking at my experiences and trying to see how I can relate to all the information, and it really makes sense. It really is, it's pretty clear, and it makes sense that that the character stuff is so much more important than the personality stuff. But we all get, you know, sucked into the personality part of it, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and all that. And it's eye-opening, very eye-opening to me.
Ray, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
One of the things I noticed as I was reading it, to me, there's a place for both of those, the personality and the character ethic. The character ethic, of course, is a longer term. It takes more effort. It's more comprehensive. But the personality ethic, too, I think has a place in that we can use some of the, I don't want to call them tips and tricks and things like that, but some of those personality things allow you to, I don't know, break the ice better with people. You know, I'm in professional sales, so a lot of what you do in professional sales, of course, has to do with, you know, a lot of these personality things, because you're trying to make people comfortable in a short period of time. And then as they get to know you and you establish the relationships with people who are customers or prospective customers, then the character thing, I think, comes in. They know that you're honest. They know that you're ethical. They know they can depend on you, that you have integrity. But in the initial meetings, I think the personality stuff does have a place.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you, Tom, in the sense that I believe that personality is what gets you in the door. It's character that's what keeps you there. You know, sort of like if you think about it, you know, I read this book by Larry King several years ago, and it was about, you know, how to break the ice, how to talk to anyone, I think it was called. And, you know, that's really the personality ethic for me, is really understanding the techniques involved in much of what I think Dr. Covey is talking about. And then character ethic is really the building, the internal building process for being able to do that, at least in the private victory area of the Seven Habits paradigm. And so, yeah, I don't particularly discount Dale Carnegie's work, for instance. You know, like the idea that, you know, you should look people in the eyes and, you know, have a genuine interest in them. I mean, with a specific emphasis on being genuine. I mean, you can't fake being genuine. That's sort of counter to the reality of it. And I really do believe that if you have a genuine interest in people, a genuine curiosity about people, you'll be more successful in life. And those are things that really make a lot of difference. And I think there's a huge body of work in the personality ethic world. And so I think there is a place for it. But certainly the character ethic is so much more important, I think, at least it is to me, in being able to build integrity and all those pieces of your life. You know, having your life integrated, I think, is really important. And that's something that has to be done on a character level.
But I'd add in that... And I love what you said, Tom. That totally makes sense. But I would add in that if I was being sold to by a salesperson, right? If you can almost like sense whether or not there is that character in the first place, you know, And if there wasn't that in place already, then no matter what you do personality traits wise, I'm still going to be repelled from it, you know? So I don't think it's a 1-2. I think the character ethic is there all along. And I'm sure you feel that because you've got that already there. You know what I mean? It's not like you sort of turn one on and turn one off kind of thing.
I absolutely agree with you on that. I think the character ethic has to be the foundation on which to build. And that takes a long time and a lot of effort. And it has to be real sincere, because people can see right through a veneer of you know, fakeness, or, you know, the glad handing, the car salesman with the plaid jacket kind of look, you know, that you can just tell. But I like what Ray said, because it's the character ethic that keeps you there. You know, you can get in the door. I think to have those long lasting relationships, you've got to have that essential foundation of, you know, honesty, ethics, all those different things, or you're not going to be successful, not in the long run.
So at this point, I'd like to discuss the sort of absolute principles that Covey believes exist in all human beings, and, you know, these sort of natural laws that he talks about that are sort of the underpinnings of society and, you know, being human, the human condition, basically. And I found them to really be interesting to me because I might have referenced this in a prior call, but Stanford teaches a humanities course called The Art of Living. And it's led by Professor Kenneth Taylor. And Dr. Taylor teaches the art of living basically through literature. It's a team professor situation. So I think three professors get together led by Dr. Taylor. And Dr. Taylor is a professor of philosophy there at Stanford. And they teach the course by teaching different pieces of literature, basically asking, what is a life worth living? And it's really a very fascinating structure that goes through all these pieces of literature. And they're teaching pretty much different components. And Dr. Covey mentions a couple of them. He mentions the natural laws being fairness, integrity, honesty, dignity, service. And he goes on and on with several more examples. And I'm curious, from the folks on the live call, what you believe those basic underlying assumptions are of the character ethic. What are those things that are the foundation for you? I know that specifically for me, you know, pretty much all of them that Dr. Covey mentioned were foundational for me. I mean, fairness, the concept of justice and so forth are really important to me, and certainly integrity and honesty. And I don't know how many of these underlying natural laws they are, but as he went and started making a list of them, more kept getting added in my mind in terms of, you know, these distinct areas of our condition. Love and compassion is one of those that comes to mind, and so I'm now keeping sort of a running list of these and trying to relate them back into areas of my life that I really want to focus on making sure a part of where I am and what I'm doing.
Well, there are a couple that aren't in there that to me are important, and one of those is compassion, to have compassion. I guess that might go kind of hand in hand a little bit with justice, but compassion to me is really important. Being grateful, or thankfulness is important, along with the other list that they talk about. Those are just two that I think seem to be missing from that. But I think we're all going to be, I think we'd all have different things that in that list that we would say is really important or not as important. They're all to some degree important, but I don't think one size is going to fit all in that particular situation.
No, not at all. And absolutely, compassion and gratitude are two that are missing, and certainly are so important in the grand scheme of things. Dr. Covey, you know, shows these drawings of the experiment of a younger and older woman, and he does this in order to sort of teach us about the individual concept of perception. And so I'd like to talk about how personal conditioning, this idea that society provides us with these, you know, whether it's society or, you know, going further below that to parents and other types of authority in our life as we grow up, it colors our perspective, you know, in our own experiences. And I'm curious about objectivity then for all of us when we're trying to learn about the habits. How do you achieve objectivity when you know that you are conditioned by the subjectivity of all of these other pieces of the puzzle? Does anybody have any thoughts about how you achieve objectivity? Are there things that you do, you know, rituals, or do you ask yourself questions? I know that for me, I'm very much of the what is true about the situation, you know, especially when I'm dealing interpersonally. One of the big things that I always ask myself is, or tell myself, is that, you know, when someone tells me, especially this comes up a lot, you know, so-and-so is this type of person, positive or negative. And I frequently have to say to myself, if in the objective perspective, that's that person's perception of that individual. And that's great. And I may trust that person fully in being who they are. But it's really important for me then to also understand that that person probably has another side to them, and that I could talk to another person and that person could have a completely different perspective on that individual. And so I do always say to myself, at least in interpersonal relationship issues, you know, when someone's like, oh, that person's that kind of person, that I always say, okay, that's that person's, that one individual's perception.
Hey, Ray, it's Michelle.
Hey.
So 20 years ago I read the book, and I read that example about the man on the subway with his kid running wild and the other people on the subway getting annoyed, and then the guy saying, can you control your kids, please? Because, you know, New Yorker, that's what you experience on a regular basis. And, you know, and then the man saying, I'm so sorry, their mother just died, and I really don't know what to do. So, and I have for years have used that example, and I keep it, you know, like tucked away in my mind, and I'm always thinking about it. I didn't realize it was Dr. Covey's direct experience, so that was really funny to read that and be like, oh, that's where it came from. But I really try and remember that everything isn't as it seems. You know, there's more to the story. There always is. Truth or not truth, it's somebody else's experience is their truth of the situation, you know? So I really try and look at everything objectively, and I try and take my own emotions out of it and my own perspective out of it. And I really do try and stand in their shoes and maybe see what I can see. But then also realize that there's so much more going on in their own world that I probably can't even see necessarily what their perspective is. But, you know, the saying goes, there's three truths, the his, hers, and the real, or whatever, however the saying goes. I know I'm getting it wrong, but there's, you know, there's multiple levels to truth always. So I just always try and be objective as much as possible.
Makes sense to me.
This is Tom. I think a lot of times we have a situation where people don't realize that perspective affects your perception of the truth, whatever the truth might happen to be. I kind of saw that, you know, you see that a lot, when, especially in something as polarizing as, say, politics, where you're exposed, a lot of people are exposed to one particular viewpoint, whether it be conservative, whether it be liberal. And if they continue to have that constant diet of just liberal or just conservative information, news, that sort of thing, media exposure, then that's going to taint how they see the world in just about every aspect. So to kind of get back to your question about what you do to be aware of having a certain perspective, I think it's important to expose yourself to different viewpoints, expose yourself to different people, different different attitudes as much as possible. I'm not saying abandon what you believe to be true and that sort of thing, but at least we have to be open-minded. Otherwise, our perspective, I don't think, and our perception will have no basis in truth, because I think we get manipulated a lot by media, by advertising, by sometimes the books we might read, and we just get that narrow, narrow focus of how we see the world. I think it's just real important that we expose ourselves to a lot of viewpoints.
I think that's great advice. I think it's one of those principles that is really important for us to all understand. I mean, I know that for myself. I've had several circumstances actually in the past year where long-time thoughts that I believed were universal axioms, you know, just say that was a reality, that scientific truth. And, you know, then talking to someone it challenged that, and it did two things. One, it allowed me to go back and research that concept more and say, is this really true? What's real now? You know, is there more science about this issue? And one confirmed it. You know, one in one particular instance, it helped strengthen my view on the position because now we do have more foundation, more understanding of the concept. And I was really appreciative of that. And then the other one was sort of like, well, that's not so conclusive. And it allowed me to actually learn a whole host of new information about something that was not necessarily there before. And it didn't change my view, as you said, but it certainly made me more aware of the issue. It's far more gray than it is black and white. And I think that's always really good to have that, you know. I always like to tell everybody that I like to be the dumbest person in the room because I'm always absorbing everything around me. And I wish that, you know, that was always the case, but I always keep that in mind so that I was, you know, listening better and capable of hearing all the nuggets from everybody that's flying around usually in meetings.
Well, that's one I'm going to write down. I love that. I like to be the dumbest person in the room. That is fantastic.
Well, it's also nice to have lots of really smart friends, and so it keeps you challenged. But I do like to be the dumbest person in the room. So I'd like to talk about Dr. Covey's inside-out approach to effectiveness and what it really means for us all, in the sense that we have to, you know, we have to work on these inside pieces in order for the outside pieces to really work. And I'm guessing, you know, he really wants us to focus on, you know, the movement toward independence first, and that means controlling the things about ourselves. And I'm curious about that. You know, do you believe that the inside approach to effectiveness is, as Dr. Covey says, the only way toward this place where you have a strong mastery of the character act?
Hey, it's Michelle again. I think it's really important to work from the inside out. I always have. It makes real sense to me that that you have to have, I guess, strong understanding of yourself and what motivates you and the like in order to be able to relate to other people in a real way with full integrity, because it's too easy to be manipulated otherwise, you know, and to be really aware of yourself and what your motivating factors really helps clarify things when, you know, when things come into question, you have a real solid base to fall back on and to make your decisions from. It's kind of the same, in a very not esoteric way, it's the same as planning a project, you know, and this brings you to the effectiveness part. It's, you know, if you know, and I guess it's one of the next habits, but if you know what the end result is that you're working towards and what the important features are along the way, it's easier to make decisions when things go awry, when questions come up, when, you know, plans change. It's easier to come up with, you know, plan B, plan C, plan D when you are very clear on the real purpose of it all. So that's my thoughts on it.
Great, thanks.
This is Denise. I agree with Michelle, and I think inside out is the only way you can. But I would add that when you have worked on yourself and you're comfortable in your own space, it gives you your own, it's not just self-awareness, but it's also your own self-confidence. So when those things happen, you can shift gears pretty easily. It's not, you can just, I lost my train.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Denise. It really does give you the self-confidence to be able to move on to the next step without doubting what, you know, what it was that you were moving towards. I like that a lot.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me about the inside-out approach is that it relates so much to, as we talked about some time ago on one of the calls, about John G. Miller's The Question Behind Question and personal responsibility or personal accountability. For me, it comes down to the buck stops and starts with me. And, you know, my responsibility to being a better spouse, being a better leader, being a better, you know, friend, being a better uncle, you know, whatever it is for me when I need to step into a situation it's the things that I've created as purposes and principles, the guidelines for how I act in the situation versus how I'm attempting to persuade or change other people. You know, you really can't change other people. Or as Marcus Buckingham would probably say, you know, people don't change that much. So, you know, you really do have to come back to you and start there. And so I definitely agree with both of you in that sense. So moving along, Dr. Covey talked about the definition of habits and the role they play in our lives. And I'm curious about your definition of habits, how they relate, where does Covey's habits definition sort of work for you and where don't they work for you? As someone who's studied habits for many, many years, I'm curious about where your habits sort of fall. Do they fall in line with a closer definition to, say, Thomas Aquinas, in that sense, or do they fall into a more scientific perspective of behavioral mechanisms? I'm just curious about people's thoughts on habits and how they relate to Covey's concept of the seven habits. I'm actually rifling through now to actually pull open the exact definition. And he says, for our purposes, we will define a habit as the intersection of knowledge, skill, and desire. So knowledge is the theoretical paradigm, the what to do and the why. Skill is the how to do, and desire is the motivation, the want to do. And he says that you need all three. And I'm just curious about that because many times I you know, looking at it from a purely scientific basis, and that's not where he's coming from with this, but looking at it from a scientific basis, I don't see the motivation necessarily there when it comes to habits. So I'm always having to bifurcate those two thoughts in my understanding of the seven habits.
It's Michelle.
Hey.
I recently read The Power of Habit by William Baring. Is that right? Something like that. But anyway, it was very interesting because it was about the cycle, you know, the trigger or the cue, basically the action and then the reward, right? And how you could sort of change a habit by changing the keeping the cue and the reward being the same and changing the behavior that's in between. Very scientific, very hands-on, very how to fix it kind of situation, right? But still a lot of understanding, a lot of thought, and recognizing what all those parts are is not easy. So let me not make it sound like it's, you know, oh, you just swap it out. definitely not. But in reading Covey's description, like I think it was actually a little bit past where you just read, right? There he went into a little bit more about the motivation behind it and a little bit more about like it has to be in line with your intrinsic beliefs, your intrinsic, you know, character. And that's what a habit is. It's something that you do and it's something that you completely believe in at that point, right? And I might be getting this all completely wrong, but what I found it very interesting to think about, you know, because of course there's habits that I want to change or habits I'd like to create, and I'm still struggling with that. And thinking about it down to the very core level of the why, what is it that I really, really want to accomplish, and do I really care about it that enough to create a habit around it, you know, or to change that habit? And that's been very interesting, a very interesting paradigm shift.
Anyone else with thoughts of habits? Otherwise, we'll just move along.
Yeah, I was just going to make a point that the first time I read this book and he talked about a definition of habit, to me it just seemed revolutionary because I always thought of habit as something we just kind of unconsciously, automatically do because we're used to it or because it's comfortable or because there's a trigger that makes us engage in it, like smoking or saying, you know, or the way we might dress or the way we go to work every day, or just, you know, it's just something that we just kind of do automatically. The idea that we had these three aspects of a habit to me was just amazing, that you could break it down into the skills, the knowledge, and the desire, and then think, well, gosh, you know, I'd like to make some good habits, but to do that, I've got to have all three of these things. To me, that was just a leap that no one else had ever taken, you know, 20 years ago. And I thought it was really profound.
That's awesome. That's so great that it triggers for you such a great response and ability for you to, you know, look at it from that different perspective. I think that's great. So at this point, I'd like to hop into the actual habits and starting off with the first habit, which is be proactive. And I'm sort of curious, what does being proactive mean to you and what qualities do you think you need to be proactive? Not just what Cubby says, but, you know, can you describe for me what being proactive for you is in your life? And I'd like to just know what that means to you. I'll start off with this, with the perspective that I come to the word proactive with great trepidation because, you know, you hear it so often in corporate speak today, probably part because of Covey's popularity, you know, when he first published the book. And so people, you know, are consistently talking about being proactive. And I've actually jokingly been saying over the last decade or more that people should actually just be active, probably hearkening back to sort of the GTD principles of action management as opposed to too much planning and too much reviewing and not enough doing. But I really do believe that proactivity, from my perspective, is really being actively working on the process. You know, that you are, that you're doing all of the parts of planning, reviewing, and doing. And if you're doing those things, then in the planning stages, you're thinking about what's going to happen. In the reviewing stages, you're thinking about what's been done and what can be done better, iterating, basically. And therefore, that's really being proactive. So I'd like to hear other people's thoughts in terms of what proactive is to you.
Well, my definition of proactivity has always been just you're not waiting for something to happen to you and then responding to it. You're anticipating, you're taking a preemptive move to affect an outcome. It's kind of like you're not just rolling with the punches, so to speak. You're trying to add direction to where you're headed, to what you're doing in your life, instead of just responding to what happens to you on a, you know, on a daily or even, you know, hourly basis. You're actively pursuing goals, or you're actively pursuing a dream. To me, that's what I think of when I think of proactivity.
That's a great definition. I like that. It's pragmatic.
Hey, it's Michelle. I think for me, being proactive, and I agree with both of you so far, it's really being engaged. And for me, sometimes there's a lot of build up prior to action. I actually put a lot of thinking into things, and really try and look at things from all sorts of points of view. But I think it's also about giving yourself the space to see those different sides, and to not have snap judgments sometimes when it's not appropriate. Sometimes it's appropriate. But I also think, well, you know, sometimes you have to react in a situation, but, those are usually the times where I'm like, oh, I wish I hadn't done it that way. But having, like, sort of like I mentioned before, having thought sort of all the possibilities out, or at least some of them, so that it's sort of already been through my mind and I've already, sort of made pre-decisions in a sense. That helps, you know, that helps me be able to navigate those situations. But the other thing about proactivity is sometimes you find yourself in a situation and things are happening to you and you're like, what's going on, right? And that's, to me, proactivity is sort of recognizing that that's happening and then changing it, you know, because we often find ourselves in those situations. And that's, you know, that's part of life. But being able to recognize it and then do something about it, that's hugely proactive to me.
Wonderful. Any more thoughts on proactivity or being proactive before we move on to the next habit? Okay, cool. So the next habit is habit number two, beginning with the end in mind, or begin with the end in mind. And I'm curious about how you really think about and apply the idea of defining your own personal principles. And of course, this brings us back to the idea of establishing mission statement. And having been someone from a Covey world, I know that we've talked on the call many times about having a mission statement, whether you have one, and what would you or does it consist of? I'm curious that if you haven't already, why haven't you developed a personal mission statement? That's not an issue of judgment, but really, genuinely, there's likely a reason, and I'm curious about that. So, folks online, mission statement, have you built one, and what does it consist of? Why or why not? Maybe you're willing to share yours if you have it. I might share mine if you all want to hear it. I know that I used lots.
I'd love to hear yours, Ray.
I'll probably exempt some of the pieces of it, but I'm happy to share part of this. But so my personal mission statement I'm really not a shy person, so this is I feel the emotion of giving something so personal. I think this is the first time I'm publicly stating it, but here it is. I will give equal, if not more, loyalty to the people I care about and respect in my life. I will foster my intellectual curiosity and seek out people who help encourage my intellectual curiosity. I'll be an active participant in my family. I will pull nurturing, supportive friends closer into my inner circle and not push away, but also not give energy to those that are not providing positive, productive, and healthy energy in my life's relationships. I'll be an inspiration to my spheres of influence. I will embrace my political activism and social entrepreneurship. I will work to have quality, healthy, and life-affirming relationships with the people and organizations I associate with in my life. I will be dynamic. I will define success in each category of my life and strive to achieve each one of them using well-defined goals while not losing sight of the little successes in life. I will do what I say. I will say what I mean. Per Mahatma Gandhi, I shall conquer untruth by truth, and in resisting untruth, I shall tolerate suffering. And I have promised myself to answer Dr. Robert Shuler's question, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail every day? And so that's with much of it removed, but there goes sort of the crux of really the summary pieces.
It's very nice, Ray. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
Yeah. So I haven't written a mission statement. About a year ago, I left my job. I decided that I needed a change, and now a year later, a year plus, I'm starting to reconsider getting a full-time job. I've been doing freelance in between, so you know I have a way of sustaining my life. But it's been an interesting journey for me because I was really so completely invested in my work that my life meaning was my work. It was so wrapped up in that and in my title and what my job was. So it's been a big shift for me to realize that, you know, that isn't the end all be all. And, you know, honestly, it was a purposeful delve into work to avoid the rest of my life. And I'm sort of, you know, waking up from that and saying, okay, time to get back involved and engaged. But reading Covey is very remindful of, you know, there is so much more important to life than just work. It's really your relationships. It's your relating to other people. It's your core beliefs, your principles, your intrinsic values, you know. So I'm finding it very inspiring, and remindful of what I need to start looking at and working on. And I'm realizing that my purpose in life doesn't have to be a thing. It doesn't have to be an end, award. It doesn't have to be a job title, you know, or money or income or like that. It's really about like, have I lived as a good person? What means good to me, and hopefully would match the overarching sort of eternal consciousness kind of thing. But that is really so much more important than any kind of materialistic goal. Anyway, sorry, long story, but that's kind of where I am on my mission journey.
That's great. That's great to know that you're in process. And I always find it to be interesting because people sometimes believe that a mission statement needs to be, like mine is, a prose or anything like that. Like it can't be bullet points or it can't be a picture or it can't be, you know, something that you draw or just something that you understand. I mean, really the fact that you're looking at all of these pieces and just knowing what it is important. I think that's really great.
Yeah.
Dr. Covey. Yeah, and Dr. Covey gives you all of the pieces to write a mission statement in the Seven Habits. So, I mean, it's not like you can't do it that way. I think anybody who
right.
has and endeavors to do that, that's great. I just also, I just happen to believe that you don't have to do that. A mission mm-hmm. statement can be what you want it to be. So I commend you for that.
Yeah,
Michelle, I think that's terrific. I having this conversation today, I realized I wrote my mission statement exactly following the Covey little list of all the different ways that you can think about your life, and then use this little framework to come up with some, mine is just basically some affirmations. And as y'all like to know, I don't hide too much here. I'm happy to share. Mine's not nearly as eloquent as Ray's, but I wrote it a long time ago. Now, I had not really thought about it. I guess I wrote it about 15 years ago, I'm thinking, somewhere around there, maybe even closer to, right after the book came out. And when you were talking about how, it's about living a good life and being, the right, a good person, I kind of glanced at this and I was surprised at how little I have in there about making money and being successful and all those kind of things. When I share this with you in a moment, you'll kind of see that. I so many people, I think of mission statements as a way to, for material wealth and how to be successful and that sort of thing. But when you go through the Covey way of coming up with this mission statement, it doesn't come out like that. I'll share some of mine with you if y'all would like to hear it.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
I act with honesty, integrity, humility, and maturity in my personal, professional, and spiritual roles. I value the love, trust, confidence, respect, and admiration of my wife and sons. I keep a sense of humor in my daily affairs. I seek spiritual enlightenment every day. I take time to appreciate God's grace and majesty each day. I provide my family with spiritual, financial, and emotional stability and security. I act with genuine love and concern in my family, friends, and professional relationships. I keep myself physically healthy. I'm neatly groomed. I discover and fulfill the expectations, wants, needs, and desires of my family, friends, and business relations. I treat animals with respect, dignity, and love. I stimulate my mind on many worthwhile, important topics. And then the last one is, I dream to expand my personal, mental, spiritual, and professional horizons. That's me in a nutshell right there, guys.
That's beautiful.
Nothing I've written in the last 20 years has probably had more of an impact than those few statements. I try to live by them. I fail miserably most of the time, but I strive for it. I think Covey says in one of his other books that his wife goes, well, when is that going to happen? And I'm sure my wife says the same thing. When is that going to happen? But that's
well,
the ideal, and it's something to strive for, at least for me anyway. So.
Well, Tom, I have to disagree with you on one point, and one point alone, which is that thinking that my mission statement was any more eloquent than yours is absolutely abominable. they were beautiful words. Thank you for sharing them.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
And so I'd like to close out the discussion with, of course, habit 3, and that is put first things first. And this is where Covey jumps into and introduces time management as a piece of this whole habit, and where probably it gets pulled mostly into the productivity book group's mission of productivity, I guess, even though we won't particularly always be so strict about that. But he introduces the Merrill Covey time management matrix, the idea of 4 quadrants, and, it's one of the most popular and enduring messages, I think, from 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And just as a brief overview, it's 4 quadrants. If you look at it from an XY axis of important and urgent, and so quadrant 1 is important and urgent, 2 is important but not urgent, 3, urgent but not important, and 4, not urgent and not important, or not urgent or important. And so I'm curious, have you analyzed your work and personal life activities into that matrix? And what have you learned? What insights have you learned from looking at it from that perspective? I know that when I first came across the Merrill Covey matrix, I was so excited about it. I just thought, it just blew my mind, that I hadn't thought of it myself yet, of the reality of time and urgency and, of course, its values. And so I immediately took everything in my life in terms of, at that time, I had sort of life categories, a little more Tony Robbins than not. and these categories of inclusion in, and I had, you know, sort of put them into the Merrill Covey matrix, and then I started putting all of my tasks throughout the day in them and trying to sort of manage my entire world within this structure, even though that's not particularly what he's proposing that you do. But it was one of those things where I literally created a little weekly schedule built not from the weekly schedule that he created, but sort of my own little interpretation of how to use the quadrants. And I found myself really finding it to be fascinating to review my weeks. But as I was looking at my weeks and like I was keeping track of my time because of the time I was working on billable hours for the firm I was working for. And so I was going back and literally placing each of those things into the time management matrix, see where they all fit. And it was really fascinating to see.
Hey, it's Michelle. So I'll admit that I haven't read that chapter yet. I'm still working on it, so I don't have a fresh understanding of his thoughts there. But I have used the matrix in the past, and I actually even created a spreadsheet that sort of like, you know, you put in numbers and it plops it in the right place. And I found it very helpful to make sure that I was, because at the time I had like 100 tasks going at the same time. You know, of course, when you plot it out, almost all of them show up in the upper left quadrant as urgent and important. But there's also the, you know, not urgent, but also super important things. And those can easily fall by the wayside. So having sort of a clarity that those things are falling by the wayside, but they are still really important is really helpful.
Absolutely.
You know, because you don't want to lose like the bigger picture and the longer perspective and, you know, like, so say in business, you know, when you're in the midst and dealing with the fires and in the weeds and whatnot, you don't want to forget that you have to build a strong structure in order to support the ongoing business, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I don't know if I've ever described this here on Productivity Book Group before, but I do what's called a daily productivity ritual. I have a sort of slightly based on several different people's works. But one of the things that I do is that I take all of my quadrant two items and I focus on one of those quadrant two items every day. And so, you know, I've had a little card and I actually happen to write it on it among many other things, but that one particular quadrant is where I focus on the important but not urgent things because they, as Dr. Covey says, you know, you tend to have those go by the wayside. And you're absolutely right, Michelle, you tend to not focus on them because you don't, you know, whether they're important and urgent or important and not urgent, sometimes urgent things show up and they happen to not be important when you look back on it. And so it's nice to know that you have at least for me, it's nice to have a physical representation for me in front of me, reminding.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
All right, as you know, I've talked to you before about this. I use the quadrant method a lot. It's almost internalized now. It's not something I really have to write down and list, but I kind of use the quadrant method to connect me to my mission statement. For an example, if something is a quadrant two activity, it's important, but it's not urgent. I find that those kind of activities usually tie in to the things that I've in my mission statement that I just read to you. And if it's not important and not urgent, and you know, like watching television, that doesn't tie into my mission statement. But maybe if I'm watching television with my son and having quality time with him while we're doing it, maybe, or watching a movie on TV, then that might go into my mission statement. It gives you a way to evaluate your activities. To me, just really quickly, and then when you're doing we're doing our weekly review or we're looking at what activities we're going to engage in that week, we can see what's really important and what ties into that mission statement. Because if you internalize that mission statement, it really, really, truly is important to you, then anything that advances you closer to that ideal expressed in your mission statement, you're going to find that's going to be usually a quadrant two activity every time. And that's kind of how I've used it over the years for, you know, many, many years. But it's not something that I consciously do much anymore. I don't think quadrant two. I just think, well, is that important? Is that really urgent? But again, my favorite is to just throw it into the not urgent, not important, and go, well, God, you know, that's something I don't need to spend any time on at all. Try to ignore it.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I love the quadrant method. It's kind of a real lifesaver for me over the years.
That's great. That's fantastic. And I like your use of meshing the GTD concepts with Covey, because as someone who probably does it in a different flavor than you, I am very much a makeup of those two in terms of my productivity framework. And so that's really great. Does anyone have any final thoughts about parts one and two and the first three habits of highly effective people, of the seven of them, before we close out the call? Any burning thoughts?
Well, the only thing I'm surprised we didn't talk about was Viktor Frankl, the part in the book where he talks about going through all the agonies of the Jewish, the German concentration camp, and mm-hmm. how he was tortured, and he said they could harm my physical body, but they couldn't really harm me, and that's always been really a incredible statement to me, and I think I've never read his book. I wish I had. I just haven't taken time to do that. But it's kind of like whenever you face adversity or a difficult time. To me, that's just such practical knowledge that Frankl had. Is that no matter what happens, no matter what tragedy may face you, or what difficulty or what hurdle, it can't harm you, who you actually are, unless you allow it to happen. And that's what, to me, was one of the most interesting things in the entire book, and it's something that has always stuck with me over the years, is the idea that you can experience all this difficulty in life and all these problems and all these, hardships, but unless you allow it to affect you, who you are, it can't. And I know that's a really deep thing to end the end the conversation on, but I just thought that was such an incredible story, and I've seen it referenced many, many times in the productivity literature over the years.
I'm so glad that you bring up Dr. Frankl. I mean, his work is absolutely phenomenal, and his story is even more profound and phenomenal, being a Holocaust survivor and so forth. And his book, Man's Search for Meaning, I highly, highly recommend it. You will really appreciate the material. It's a great, popular reading of a piece of material that, he's the founder of logotherapy, the existential analysis concept. And, as a lover of all things psychology, it's a really fascinating and wonderful book. So I highly recommend it, and thank you for noting that. So as is the tradition here on Productivity Book Group, to end every call with my favorite quotation from our book's current reading selection, here it is, quote, "Between stimulus and response, man has the freedom to choose," end quote. Thank you, Dr. Covey. Well, that finishes out this Productivity Book Group discussion for the first two parts of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Powerful Lessons in Personal Change by Dr. Stephen R. Covey. I have a few announcements. First, our next Productivity Book Group call will take place on Saturday, September 28th at noon Eastern Time, where we will continue our discussion with parts 3 and 4, basically the public victory side. If we're working toward interdependence, the public victory side, habits 4 through 7 of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Next, all information about Productivity Book Group is posted to productivitybookgroup.org. That's productivitybookgroup.org, and the podcasts are archived there under episodes. Also, please note that future books will now be posted for the next 3 months forward on the website under upcoming books. So if you go over to productivitybookgroup.org right now, you'll be able to find upcoming books as a new page on the site, and it will show the next 3 books beyond the current one that we'll be discussing. So all of the books through December are on the site now. If you'd like to get ahead or plan to read a book a little more slowly, head on over to the website and check out the upcoming reading selection. I hope you'll be able to join us for the live call on September 28th at noon Eastern Time, or subscribe in iTunes or elsewhere to listen to the archives. Finally, if you've enjoyed being on the live call or listening to podcasts, please review us on iTunes. It helps build our community here at Productivity Book Group. Here's to your productive life. Thanks to everyone who's on the call.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye, guys. Have a good week.
And
you too.
Yeah, bye-bye. It was great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.
You too.
All right. Take care, guys.
Bye.